Tonight on this recorded segment of Extension 720, we talk to two friends, friends of one another, who have just authored their second novel, co-authored their second novel. One of them is Daniel Lenihan. The other has a name of some familiarity, I think, Gene Hackman. Are you that same Gene Hackman?
I'm the same guy, actually, yeah. Yes.
You look like him, too. I think it's probably the case. I've just been looking over the list of your films. And I think I've seen probably most of them, and it's been going on for quite a while, has it not?
Yes, some 50-odd years.
My goodness.
Yeah.
But you begin your life in Danville?
Danville, Illinois, yes.
Right in the neighborhood, virtually.
Mm-hmm, 120 miles south of here. Chicago played a big part in my early life. I had relatives who lived in Indiana Harbor and Calumet City, and so it was always a treat for me as a young man to come up here.
And Chicago plays an important role, or rather, the Chicago scene is very important in the new novel Justice for None, and indeed, somebody who works in this building is important in this story as well.
Yes, exactly. Myrna, who is very important to the story.
Yeah, Myrna's a female reporter that...
For the Chicago Tribune.
For the Chicago Tribune. And at a time when being what was called a front page girl was a pretty special thing to be, you know, there were very few women who were writing other than society columns or allowed to write them at that time.
But we're in Vermilion or Danville, and Chicago circa 1929, 1930.
Exactly, yes.
A long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Let's come back to the story in a moment, Justice for None, that novel just published by St. Martin's Press. But something about your partnership. You guys are neighbors, is that right?
Yes, we both live in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Yeah.
We get together once a week or so, throw ideas around about writing projects and that kind of thing.
And we know what Gene Hackman does in life. Dan Lenihan does something equally interesting and adventurous. You do much of it underwater, apparently.
That's right. I've worked as an underwater archaeologist for the National Park Service for about 32 years.
What does that really mean, underwater archaeology?
Well, in this case, what it means is someone who's really dealing with maritime preservation underwater. When you work for the Park Service, it's not so much a go down, find it, and grab it up as a go down, find it, take care of it for posterity. I wrote a book on that, by the way, called Submerged, which came out a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm. Giving an account of your adventures?
Yes, yes.
Poking around underwater?
That's right. For that team, the underwater archaeological team, the adventures of that team working around the U.S. and the parks and overseas and on the Arizona and Pearl Harbor and things of that sort.
Oh, really? You've gone down underwater to the Arizona?
Yeah. One of the places that we were charged with taking care of was the USS Arizona in Pearl Harbor. It describes the first dives that took place and that we did on that site and many overseas. And
This new book of yours, Justice for None, is this new collaborative volume, is your second. And the first one is a sea story, is it not?
Yes, exactly. Takes place in 1805. Kind of a seafaring novel, reminiscent of... I don't know, Moby Dick.
Possibly a little reminiscent of Patrick O'Brien as well.
Yes. Well, it's strangely enough, neither one of us had read Patrick O'Brien.
Really? Yeah.
Most of our impetus, if you will, for the book came from either Melville or Jack London, that kind of
Forrester,
thing.
In
my case, some of the 1930s movies that took place at sea, Errol Flynn type things.
Oh, yes?
Yes. It was great fun. It was one of those things where it was a lark. We never really thought early on that we would get the book published because we were both kind of neophytes at the process. But After a three-year period, we managed to hone it down to...
Came to be a pretty serious endeavor about that time.
And collaboration is not an easy thing to do.
No, it isn't.
Gilbert and Sullivan had a hell of a time, though. They produced some fine art. How well do you guys get along when you're writing a book together?
I think we get along pretty well. Probably the more difficult things are, you know, obviously the tougher it is to get along. We critique each other's work at least once a week, you know, maybe 10 pages of the development, both character and story, and we've had our bumps, you know, but they seemed to, many times the troubled times seemed to produce some of the most interesting work.
Am I correctly informed that you divide up the territories, the one works from the front of the book and the other works from the back?
Well, in the first book, actually, I wrote what I would call an audition piece that, because I hadn't written this style of...
Uh-huh.
I'd written some monologues for actors and that kind of thing. But... So I went home after a kind of a tremendous, tumultuous meeting that we had in a cafe when we decided to write the first novel. And I went home and wrote this audition piece, which ended up in the book, actually. And it was in the middle of the book, and that's probably where that story came about. So we then went back to the beginning and worked in a kind of more conventional way.
Yeah, that book, by the way, Wake of the Perdido Star, was it's a very different book than this one, but I think and we even changed the process a little bit, you know, how we worked from points of view and all that sort of thing. It's been a real education, hasn't it, Gene? I mean, the last few years, it's been
great.
Well, this one, Justice for None, has echoes also, hasn't it, of The Fugitive. The television series, and then the film.
Somewhat, in that there is a there is that process. Yes,
a man falsely accused of murdering his wife.
Yes, and somebody else also. Yeah, there. I hadn't thought of that, but that probably, you know, we do work out of our subconscious, so maybe those images kind of stuck.
Where did you ever learn about how to run a trolley car? The first chapter starts with our hero.
Yes.
As the engineer or motorman, what do you call him, on a trolley
car? He's I guess an engineer, yes. We did some research on that and made some of it up. There's not a lot of stuff out there on trolley cars. Not many of them exist any longer in the United States. The impetus for that was, in fact... we did have a trolley car in my hometown, which went right in front of my house. And the event that takes place in the book that starts this kind of ball rolling actually took place next door to me.
Yeah. Oh, a real
event? Yeah, it was a real event. That part of it was real. And then we...
You mean the murder?
Yes, the murder.
Mm-hmm.
That part was... I was about... 6 years old, I suppose, something like that. And we moved the book, the dates of the book, back to 1929 to take advantage of the stock market crash and the depression.
Yeah. Whereas when you were 6 years old, it would have been, I think,
1936. Yes, exactly.
You were born in
1930.
Yes. Yeah. The book is quite evocative of that scene. That is Midwestern, mid-sized town life. Mm-hmm. In the Depression, in just before the Depression and then in the Depression years.
Yeah, thank you. One of our goals probably in writing the book, and Dan, you can jump in on this too, but I think we had decided early on that we wanted a very atmospheric book, if you will, something that evoked the times and the way people thought and maybe an easier time in U.S. history.
Right, and we put characters in it, I think, that represented for us people coming at it from different walks of life that were going to be facing this the precipice here of the Depression. As we mentioned, there's a is a woman reporter. There's also an African-American who plays a major role.
In the partnership between Boyd and George is really, again, is very evocative. It's evocative, really, of all the strains between whites and blacks that prevailed in those days and which still linger
in
some ways.
I think so. I mean, it hits both the, I think it explores the strains, and it also, I think explores the basic humanity which those two are able to eventually extend to each other, even in the, you know, in the face of the times. And
you use the Chicago scene quite nicely during the interval when they escape and wind up in Chicago as day laborers.
Yeah, Boyd works in the stockyards, which the research on that was fascinating for me, especially you come up with the facts about how many different nationalities actually worked in the stockyards, and the process. We left a lot of the real process out because it's fairly gory and not very wholesome.
Did you manage to, in doing research, to read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle?
Yes, actually, some of the description of the stockyard was from researching his descriptions of what that was like.
I thought the olfactory passages, the smells of the stockyards, came through with particular vividness, and it reminded me rather of that great old American novel by Upton Sinclair.
Tough to read that novel.
It is. It's not.
It's not easy.
It's rather a burden. Yeah.
Well, and it's someone who didn't come up in the Midwest. I've been my only connection to the Midwest is my wife, who is a maiden was Barbara Ham from Jacksonville. You know, I married into the Midwest, but I didn't. You know, this was not my part of the world.
Where were you from originally?
New York City. But the what was intriguing to me was so I was in a better position to see some of the connections that Gene was able to make in the writing when his manuscript materials had come to me, that you could have only have made having been coming up near that time in the Midwest. I think it's that adds a lot to the atmosphere of the book. Just the observations about it all takes place between Danville and Chicago, really.
Mm-hmm.
And these little towns and what happens
to Steger, a little town that's south of Chicago, and Kankakee, Watseka.
And I could see little parts of stories I had heard. I know that he had things he had witnessed before, kind of, and transformed into different characters.
We drove up here yesterday kind of just on purpose to show Dan some of the little towns. It's quite a beautiful drive to parts of it. Really lovely.
A little flat.
Yeah, a little flat. But it's very green now.
Yeah.
South of here.
This season.
Yeah.
It would be, yeah. But how do you account for yourselves? You're both busy with other careers. And Lord knows, when it comes to Gene Hackman, you've made so many films and you're still very active doing so. One wonders, what would motivate you to undertake a literary career at a... after so much success elsewhere?
Well, for me, it's a wonderful process. I'm able to, what I think of as be involved in the creative process without having to check to see if the lights are set or if the camera is ready or if my co-star is ready. I mean, you're by yourself, for better or for worse.
Did you say you've done some writing of monologues for?
Yes, nothing published or anything. Just
but worked into the scripts of films.
Oh no, I don't mean to imply that. It was just monologues for actors, audition type pieces, and for to study with.
You've done some film directing as well, have you?
No, I haven't. No.
You've never done a film?
I've owned a couple of properties that I was going to direct, and for one reason or other, they've just fallen about.
Only recently I encountered you, a film of a few years ago, but I ran into it on television, in which you are a president who murders his mistress.
Oh, yes. Geez, I don't even remember the name of it.
It was rather vivid, rather striking.
Absolute power.
May I ask you something, sir?
Sure.
What do you teach? You say you're a professor.
Social psychology.
Social psychology.
At the University of Chicago.
I see.
Yeah.
That must be fascinating.
Not as fascinating as what you do, too.
Sure.
We know a good deal about Gene Hackman's career because it's been a highly observed career. But we don't go along with you very often, Dan, underwater, though I was interested to learn earlier that you've done a book on your work as a maritime archaeologist.
Yeah.
Or as an underwater archaeologist.
Right. The book's called Submerged, and the Adventures of America's Most Elite Underwater Archaeology Team, which is not the most humble title, but they assured me you need to do that to sell the book.
What sort of diving equipment do you use when you go underwater for that sort of thing?
Mainly scuba, although we did with self-contained tanks, as you're used to seeing people sport diving, that sort of equipment, but maybe really advanced and robust for the underwater work.
You were raised in New York City, did you say?
Right.
So was I, as a matter of fact. I didn't wind up underwater. I just wound up being a dull academic. How'd you get into this line of work?
Well, you know, I lived across the street from the East River. And on 7th Street and Avenue D. And well, I'd like to say that was a real attractive place to dive, but it wasn't. It was
the water would have been pretty murky even in those days.
It sure did work to intrigue you about the underwater world. I watching those swirls underneath the Williamsburg Bridge, and I knew all these stories of these ships down there, full of stories and gold and that sort of thing. And I think that kind of carried, you know, and later on, I ended up in anthropology and ended up teaching in the Virgin Islands, put the two together, and pretty soon...
Well, then you have a degree in anthropology, do you?
Yeah, I have. And that's needed to for archaeology.
Yeah.
The archaeologists have the degrees, and usually in anthropology.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what particular archaeological digs of your own have you been especially involved in?
Well, a lot of them were things that took place in the, you know, for instance, in the Southwest, which is why Santa Fe, the reservoirs, which is kind of a long story in itself, but involving the Anasazi sites, prehistoric sites, went underwater. But things that you would have been more likely to be aware of are the shipwreck sites, and including the Civil War submarine Hunley, Civil War raider, the Alabama, some of the more recent wrecks like the USS Arizona, kind of a national icon in Pearl Harbor. We reestablished or went back and started re-diving it in 1983. We have every year since. Ships of Bikini Atoll from the atomic testing.
Really?
Many sites.
Is that dangerous work?
Can be.
I would think
it might.
Be.
The
because you go into the interiors of the ships underwater as well, don't you?
Yes, yes, and that's and also I've done a lot of. I used to be a cave diving instructor in Florida for many years, and that was probably some of the most dangerous work. There's also some very interesting work there in archaeology because of the prehistory that's been kind of that changed over the past 10,000 years with the since the Ice Age.
Your work, Gene, is not quite as dangerous as all that, or is it?
No, not nearly as so. We try to make it look like it's that dangerous and that the actors are in peril, but most of the time when there's real danger, somebody else steps in.
Stunt doubles, I think.
Stunt double is correct. Yeah. It's fascinating for Dan and I to get together because his world is full of reality, and mine is make-believe to most extent. And so the two kind of schools of thought about who we are and what we can do seems to work real well when we work together.
You have not written a memoir of your own, have you?
No, I have not. No.
Do you
I don't
plan to do that?
No.
Why not?
I don't think of my life as being terribly interesting. I mean, that anyone would be interested in the nuts and bolts of it. I would like to write a series of short stories that would be fictionalized in terms of what's happened to me and that kind of, or what's happened to some character. That would be exciting for me.
I've known you for years in films, so to speak, but I really don't know much about your own personal story.
Yes.
How did you get into acting to begin with?
When I got out of the Marines, I went in the Marines when I was 16, and when I got out, I went directly to New York. No, it was 1951. I spent the better part of 10 years studying, and I came back to the Midwest a couple of times for 6 month periods. I worked in WDAN television in Danville, small station with one camera at that time, early days of television. Would go back to New York and try it again, and then I worked down in Hallandale, Florida, WITV, as a kind of a intern, apprentice, whatever. Just trying to break into what I call show business, but continuing to study all that time.
Did you study in, what, an Actors Studio or one of those places?
Yes.
You were a
member of the Actors Studio. I also studied with George Morrison, who is a very highly respected acting teacher in New York. And, you know, like most actors who started in New York in those days, this gradually worked my way. My goal early on was just to get a job off Broadway. I would have been thrilled. And, of course, that happened. And then I did five or six Broadway plays and a little bit of film and television work in the early days of television. Became recognized to some degree and got larger parts in film. Bonnie and Clyde, I would say, was my kind of breakthrough film. And from then on, I was going back and forth between California and New York. Yeah. Doing.
I remember a particularly moving film, just superbly done, from Gibson's play, I guess.
I Never Sang for My Father.
I Never Sang for My Father.
Anderson, yes.
Yeah, with that was with Melvin Douglas.
Melvin Douglas, yeah. Exactly.
I forget just what year that was, but...
I think it was like 69, yeah. 70, something like that. Great experience for me. Melvin Douglas is a wonderful man, wonderful actor, kind of a no-nonsense guy. He didn't feel real well. He had emphysema at the time, and... but I learned a great deal from him in terms of how to be a professional.
But a widowed father and his adult son.
Yes.
And the son has obligations to the father and has an ambivalent relationship.
Yes, a very, very difficult situation, yeah. And which happens to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good time in my life, too, because I was being offered very interesting, challenging roles.
Well, you've been a sort of man of all work, it seems, in your acting career. That is, the roles you've played are extremely varied.
Yes, I like that. I've been very lucky to be offered a variety of things, both comedy and light things, and then very heavy drama, which I just think I've been enormously lucky to not be really typecast.
Yeah.
And they do that in films, you know.
Of course they do.
They love to put you in a slot.
Yeah.
But I've had a good time.
What sort of life do you guys lead down in Santa Fe?
Well, it's Santa Fe's probably it's very different from the places either one of us have come from before Santa Fe. You know, it's remember, it's really I think people sometimes picture it as desert or something, but it's at 7,000 foot, and it's really on the edge of the mountains. A great place to hike, spend time, just living, wouldn't you say, Gene?
A lot of culture there. Too.
Yes.
Oh, a lot of culture. A lot of music.
Hey, you got the whole opera company down there, haven't you?
World-class opera.
At Art.
And a lot. There's something like 300 art galleries. It's the... I think the second most prolific place in the United States for art sales.
And I think it's interesting. It's a tricultural community also. There's a heavy Hispanic and Indian, American Indian presence in Santa Fe, and it really blends well. I mean, it makes for, it sounds like we're doing a travel, advertisement for Santa Fe, but actually I think we're both really thrilled with the place as a place to live. And
are you neighbors in close proximity?
Yeah, not town? Too far. Yeah.
We live... Yeah.
Did you meet in a bar? That's how I like to visualize it.
Okay. No, actually, Dan taught me to dive for the film The Firm.
Oh, really?
Which is 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's how we met. We're very close now, his family, and we have a really nice existence there. It's somewhat idyllic in a way. Somebody said that Santa Fe is 50 square miles surrounded by reality.
Uh-huh. Good line.
Yeah. And the bars came later.
Yeah.
I usually like to ask authors, particularly if they've just come to the literary life somewhat later than fully committed literary types, what literary influences have worked upon you? You've already mentioned Conrad and Jack London and so on. More broadly, have there been any things that you've read over the years which somehow have influenced the way in which you go at the task?
Well, I think both of us really like Cormac McCarthy, and actually, Gene introduced me to a number of writers. He was actually there was a point in my life that I wasn't reading as much as he was, and he would pass a lot of books on to me. And he particularly likes, for instance, Alan First, and I really agreed with that. I think that's
wonderful novelist who takes World War II as his scene.
Yes, I love the period. I love that. The richness of that, and the fact that he doesn't feel obliged to tell, he's not heavily involved in plot, and there is story, but you're much more interested in the characters, and so it's character driven. I would describe it as a wonderful writer. Hemingway is a big influence on me. I wish I could write as tersely as he does.
Well, that's interesting because as you said that, I realize that there's a kind of spareness in the prose in this very book, in Justice for None. Mm. It doesn't over-elaborate.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a fine line, I suppose, when in terms of description of how far to go.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want the reader to live that in themselves or not? And I like the idea of that. I like... But it is a fine line, you know. Many times you'll be a little too sparse, and people don't get it.
I think particularly with a historical novel, that's true. You know, one of the things is that we did a lot of research, but I think we were both really careful. If we knew 50 things about 1929 in some aspect of it, we'd only use one or two. You know, I think that there's too much of a tendency in a lot of novels to try to put information in there. And that's something that I think we were able to steer clear.
That's known as the Michener-ized novel.
Oh,
if you remember what Michener did. He had a big research staff who would collect thousands of facts and historical material, and just about every one of those wound up in the very, very long book.
It's interesting.
We mention WGN, actually, in the book.
Yeah, you do.
That's right.
Yeah.
Reverend Merle is waiting for the farm report.
Yeah. You know, we are, at the moment that we're recording this, we are 2 days beyond the 80th anniversary of the founding of the station.
No kidding.
And just a few nights ago, we did a program focused on that. Yeah.
When I was a young man in Danville, and I'm almost certain it was WGN, but there used to be a fellow who used to sing the news.
Oh, really?
Now, I don't know if somebody could do some research on this. But it was the funniest thing.
Really?
And, yeah, he would sing the news. It would go something like, oh, little boy walked across the railroad track. The train came along and hit him in the back. I don't think that's going to happen again in months and months and months. I don't think... And he'd go on, he'd do the whole... Uh-huh. Everything that was happening at that time.
Well, I've heard stories of the first years of WGN. I've never heard about this particular performer.
It may not have been WGN, but actually, when I was doing that, it sounds like it comes from the Deep South. But
Now watch when we do a sequel to Injustice for None. There's going to be
it's
a singing.
Gonna be in there.
It's going to appear in that.
Are you? I was about to ask you, of course, as we close. Are you working on another book, or will you?
Yes, we are, actually. We're about 250 pages into a novel that takes place about 6 months before the end of the Civil War. An escape from Andersonville prison in Georgia, and then trials and tribulations up and down the Mississippi River.
Yeah. What's your film life like these days?
I haven't worked for quite a while.
Why is that?
Out of choice. Yeah. I've done so much in the last 6-7 years, I just really decided to take a year or so off.
Mm-hmm. You may be snared by the literary life and never return to Hollywood.
You can never tell. Yeah.
If the quality of this book is a measure of what you can do alone or do together in the fine team of Hackman and Lenihan, I think you may have a long career as
Thank
a novelist.
Thank you.
Novelists together. The new book by Gene Hackman and Daniel Lenihan is titled Justice for None, and it is published by St. Martin's Press. And gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Very nice.